we connect with our friend, the talented writer, Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Hard Rocking?
Living the dream, as you know, doing what we do here on AM radio. We're bringing it back, the amplitude modulation. I think it's due for a comeback.
Guy like you never has to come back, my friend. You are always in the lead. Even if it's a subtle lead, it's a formidable lead.
I'm always looking over my shoulder, though.
I hear you. Watch out for that Reaper, too. It's always gaining, isn't he? No, I shouldn't think that way, but I was just serenaded for birthday reasons by my little friend Emma in no less than three languages outside my door. So
wow.
There you go.
Very, when is your birthday? You have a birthday? No, it's not today.
It is as we speak.
Oh,
along with Alexander Ovechkin, Sniper, Hank Williams, the original good one, country music, documentary right now. We are the September 17th Trinity.
Wow. Well, a very happy birthday to you.
I appreciate that, sir.
I rely on Facebook to tell me because I don't even remember my own birthday anymore, and I didn't see it there, so I didn't know, but I should have. And now I'm going to get a tattoo so I won't forget it.
Yeah, I scrubbed it from Facebook because people just wouldn't say anything, and it made me feel lonely. So I decided I would move on from that, and I'll tell you in covert fashion. Now we know. And now you know about Hank Williams and Alexander Ovechkin, 34. And I think can pass Gretzky for the all-time goals. I was doing the math today. So
also,
there you have it.
Actor Kyle Chandler and director Baz Luhrmann with birthdays today, too.
Is Kyle Chandler from Friends? Am I making that up?
He's Friday Night Lights.
Oh, that guy who always does that, like, I'll whisper and you'll think I'm a really good actor thing.
Yes.
Yeah, he does that in Manchester by the Sea. That's his move. That's like, yeah, see how serious and moving I am. I talk really soft.
That's his thing. You got to have a thing.
He's not making the Trinity a quartet. No.
No question about that. Speaking of Trinity, wow, what a segue. I'm a professional radio guy. Don't try this at home. We're going to talk about a trio of stories that make up the last part of your wonderful book, Buried on the Beaches, Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls, a book that I read in its entirety when I first got it, and I've gone back to reread because it's so good. And as we've said, it transcends the normal expectations for a summer beach read.
Yes, and that was my aim. And part of that originated from my own beliefs in terms of what I want my art to be. I want to do both sides of the fence, where I give a reader something that is going to hit them at the level of who they are and feel as though it was exclusively written for them. And they connect with it that way, and it has that resonance. And it is of its age and transcends its age. But at the same time, I want to entertain the rear end off of you more than anything out there, whether for you it's Game of Thrones or it's Agatha Christie novels, whatever it is. I want to do both things at once. And when I wrote this book, which is eight stories long, and they're all set on Cape Cod on a different town, and we've done these segments where we talked about three the first time and then the middle two, and now these last three, with the last one being fairly short, is I wanted to capture this place where the flora and the fauna inform the lives of these characters. And I was also writing at a time in my life when my life had fallen apart, and I was writing these other books. I was doing three books simultaneously, back to that Trinity theme, and one of them was Dark March, which we've discussed on this program, which I think is the ultimate book of heartbreak. And Dylan said when he recorded Blood on the Tracks, which might be the pop music version of the ultimate version of heartbreak, he said he didn't understand why people wanted to listen to that. And with Dark March, I tried to write this book that, again, connected with people who go through something where they think their suffering is such that it's matchless. No one else has ever been through that, because I think that's really the nature of heartache. And simultaneously, while I was doing this and fighting to keep myself going, and I was taking trips up to the woods of the North Shore and sitting next to the train tracks and thinking, okay, is this the day that we're going to go in front of one of these trains? And I'd come home and I'd work on these books. And one of them was Buried on the Beach. And Buried on the Beaches. And what I was trying to do in a way was have a vacation for myself, because I couldn't go anywhere in my life. I was limited. I was at the desk. I was waking up in the tub because of all the stress I was under. And it was a way to have a vacation. It really redefined what vacation meant for me. Now, these stories are all set on Cape Cod, but I wanted them to be relevant to you if you lived in El Paso because of the emotional content. Well, at the same time, it didn't hurt to have something that could be this perennial fixture on this place that I think is different than anywhere else in the country, because you couldn't really write a book where the setting becomes a character in so potent a way, a naturally suggestive way, as you could with Cape Cod, maybe in Alaska, that kind of thing, or the Panhandle, but you couldn't do it like in Naperville, Illinois, for instance. So that was a lot of what went into this book, which, of course, encompasses a lot of different things at once. And while being this beach read that wasn't just your summer thing that you took around with you in the rest of your life.
Let's start with Mr. Chompers, which I absolutely love. It starts with a very down note, and the narrator who gets ghosted by his wife, but then brings us into the orbit of one of my favorite characters in your work. That is Mr. Chompers, the former horror TV host who stages an unlikely comeback on radio.
He does. Now, the character who is our protagonist is lost a lot, and you get that right from this opening sentence, which, when you have an opening sentence, what you want to do is you want to put your shoulder down and really lean into the reader. You want to pop them, but in a loving way. And this story begins after my wife left me without a word of warning, not the vaguest hint that anything like that could happen. I found myself reading the labels in the backs of a lot of things I'd never considered before. Advil bottles, ketchup tubes, beer cans, salad dressing canisters. Like I was looking for some grave information I had previously missed, which would tip me off to something especially deleterious that I should have been on the lookout for, as I should have been on the lookout for fissures in my own marriage. That's all one sentence, and it goes downhill, and that's why it's able to roll with that momentum. But right away, it's put its shoulder into you, and you feel like, okay, this is going to be a struggle, and yet there's some whimsy from this guy's perspective. Granted, you're not in a wonderful place in life when you are studying the back of Advil bottles, because goodness knows what you might be looking for. But he goes to this outpost for him on Cape Cod to get away from his troubles, to be a sort of Thoreau, wrote his book about Cape Cod, Wandering the Beaches. This is what I did on a dune today. And he's doing a fiction version of that. And he encounters this person, the title character, Mr. Chompers, as he's riding buses. His days consist of riding buses across the peninsula, and he sees this same guy doing it. And he's this person who frequents this bar, and he has his own handle of Mr. Chompers, and that stems from Rudolph and the abominable snowman character in Unicorn Cornelius plucks his teeth out, and he says he's nothing without his chompers. And that's kind of what this guy's norm becomes when, like on Cheers, when Norm goes in, Norman, everything, all like that. And that's what happens. And it turns out that Mr. Chompers has a very complicated backstory. It is a talent of multiple jobs, and he has been a horror host, and he is a deep sea diver who retrieves toys essentially at the bottom of things, and he's been wrapped up in crime. And these two are going to form an unlikely union that's going to help the protagonist in its way.
By the way, I would give very good money, if it were real, to get one of the Demon Caves t-shirts.
What are the what t-shirts?
From the Demon Caves.
Right. Yeah, yeah. One of the things that I could do with this book is that I was inventing. I didn't want to have these names where I'm just going on MapQuest, right? And I'm looking up like the names of pizza places and bars and whatnot on Cape Cod. And you're inventing t-shirts. I saw this t-shirt once. I don't know if I've mentioned it on here, where I was in Hyannis. And there was the peninsula for Cape Cod. This is all innuendo, so I think I can say this.
Oh, I think you can.
And it said something like, Cape Cod, fisting the ocean since 1721. Fisting the ocean? But first of all, that's not even right. It didn't start, if it was actually doing this, fisting the ocean in 1721. It's a geological construction. it had been fisting that ocean for a much longer time. And I thought, like, wow, you can do a lot with these names. Like, in one of these stories, there is a bar called Heave To, which is a nautical term, and it sounds perfectly fine and fair. But the neon breaks down of the second component, and everyone goes to the bar called Heave, which also works. So a lot of it was that cheekiness, because you are having this heartbreak and this tragedy. And I do not think that heartbreak and tragedy gets its full resonance with us if it also doesn't have its opposite, because that's how life is. When you go to the ER and someone you love is dying and lots of people are assembled there for that transition, people still laugh. It's not the Country Bears Jamboree, but somebody does make a joke, and life is still going on even with that swirling about, that miasma of pain. And this is certainly a story that is miasmic in that way. But in other ways, I feel like it's triumphant and orgastic. So again, there's a lot going on.
We see that contrast as well in the book's penultimate story, More Wood. And I love this opening. You don't have to do much to show someone the difference between Woods Hole and Falmouth beyond sending them to the representative bar of each place. And that's where we make our way to the Heave.
Yes, you go straight into this environment, this intensely localized locale. But now, right from the opening, that shoulder being put into you, we feel like we are an honorary member of this place. It's a sort of way of leaning in and saying, come along, you're welcome here, see how things work with us. And this is a story about something that I think is common right now, although it's not discussed, it doesn't come out in the open by the very nature of it, and that is people living double lives. Now, there's a character in this story named Lane Blanchard who's something of a con man. And he's in another story of mine in a different book called Between Cloud and Horizon. And I like these characters in the sense that I never feel like they belong to me. Oftentimes when I write a story, I will have the characters first and I will just wait for them to tell me. Like, I might ask you to tell me something if we were at the Starbucks or whatnot, what has transpired in their lives? And I know, because I feel like they're more real. In some ways, I know that they're more real than anyone I actually know. They're going to tell me their story. And it's just my job to be open to that and to record it and to put that out there. And they're not based on people I know or anything like that, but I know them. I know them more than I know John, or I know somebody like Emma, or I know my own family. And that's what happened with this story. It's my process as such, and it's something that I worked a long time to get to that point where I could hear these people and I could recognize their independence from me. And I'll have characters espouse things that I am personally against in my own life. And there'll be characters that won't change my views necessarily, but they're characters that I connect with or I pull for, or I wish they would do something different. And this, again, another marriage sort of story where this person finds out, he's a harbor master, he's an assistant harbor master, he has harbor master aspirations. And he learns that this person, this woman, isn't exactly who she thinks he is, nor is his friend. And yet they're not horrible, evil people. And there's this amateur porn racket going on, but it's more subtle than like, oh, that's what she was up to with this. And he finds out at the end, ultimately went down. And by then it's academic, as is so often. What matters is the blow and not so much the reason for the blow, as we find out after enough time passes.
The protagonist, who was not known as Scuds until he runs into Blaine along the way, falls in love, as you mentioned, with a girl from Glasgow, the token foreigner in the town. And then I love this part, the idea that he is so in love with her that, as you write, I have become incapable of self-preservation. I love that line.
Yes, that does certainly happen, doesn't it? And I think we first have our pangs of that when we are in the teen years when we start to think that there is nothing that could matter more than how I feel about this given person. And then we shake that off. But even right from that get-go, we are not awesome at self-preservation. We will go very far off the edge of the diving board for what we think the heart doesn't so much want, but requires in order to continue the very practice of beating. And I don't know that we've all experienced that, but I do know that we have all thought that we have had experiences along those lines. And I've learned that when you write work, if it's truly art, people will talk to you about it later as though it was written exclusively for them, and they will get it wrong. They will take it in a way such that is endemic to them, and they'll say, I went through the same thing this character did. And they might describe something that the character didn't go through at all. And it sounds counterproductive, but that's exactly what you're going for. That is exactly what it is that's going to make something pop for that person in their life right then and there, and it gives it a chance to last 1,000 years after that fact. And it helps to have a line like that that's aphoristic, that lodges easily in the mind as a portable quote. You can just roll out. It never leaves the mark it makes in your brain. That never comes undone. It's seared into those brain waves.
We're talking with Colin Fleming about his book, Buried on the Beaches, the last story in the book, Clam Sliders. And, well, the premise, don't go clam digging at Scantling's Beach. Do you want to share the reason people were told not to do that?
Yes. This is a story. I don't know any story like this story, and it's short. And it ends the book on a poeticized note, I would say, because you wonder, like Curse of the Cat People, you wonder, or Picnic at Hanging Rock, you wonder what's real and what is not. And we have local legends. Every town has its cachet of local legends. And one of the legends about this particular town in Hyannis is that this field trip, or this field hockey team of girls, went out on some field trip, and a number of them disappeared. And the rumor is that they ended up caught in the riptide, and they're buried under the sand at this beach. And if you dig down too deep, that's what you'll uncover. And it's about a person who is looking back at a time in their youth when they would bicycle out to this restaurant owned by an Irish guy named Sligo, who dressed like a pirate, to get clam sliders. Now, we've all had clam sliders. They're basically mini delicious sandwiches, like burgers, usually. But clam sliders are unusual. It would be a distinctly Cape Cod-esque concoction. But what really, I think, separates this story, or something that does anyway, is that I don't think you can identify what setting the voice is in. It's not really first person, and it's not really third person. It trends to second person, but it skirts second person. Difficult to pull off second person because it ends up becoming didactic, where you start every sentence with, you did this, you did that. It's like, okay, get off my ass, just relax. I don't need to have you coming at me that way in this short story. But it doesn't function like that. And he goes and he doesn't listen to his parents. He disobeys them and he bicycles out to this place because he's digging up something. And he's looking back. He's an adult who is digging in a different way. And it takes him back to this memory when he was a child. And he ultimately says, for he definitely does dig up something, and he has the epiphany, up it comes from the earth. And he says what it is. And it's not something that anyone, I would say, based off of what I've just said, could expect what it is. And you find out what it is, and you're just like, oh my God. I need to take the walk around the block, the solar plexus. And it's just haunting and beautiful. And the lines that it ends on, when you end the book, I don't believe in story collections because they're normally, I wrote these different pieces and I stuck them all together. These are like chapters. They're a book. The last word of the last story of something like this that I do has to be the last work of the fully integrated book. And when you come to that last word, it might as well be the word that extends hands and closes the cover, because it's done at that point. It is so done, and it's now going to travel with you out into your life.
Well, and you have certainly accomplished that with the last sentence of Buried on the Beach is what happens on the Cape stays on the Cape. I don't care if beach season is gone. Get yourself a copy of this. It's available on Amazon. It's a phenomenal read for any time of year. Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls. Colin Fleming. Colin, we thank you as always. Happy birthday to you once again. I can only say that in one language, but I'm wishing it to you in many.
It's good. It's the love language with you, Kimball. That's all that matters.
Thanks,
all right,
Colin.
See you later.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.